come to a greater understanding of the truthfulness of this record. I thought when I attended your Wednesday evening study here this last week that you might be interested in this, because most of this material is material that comes from the first book of Nephi, which you've been studying, the history and the record of this journey, this epic journey that was made so many years ago. I would like to read a text tonight. If you turn to page 63 in the Book of Mormon, that's in 1 Nephi chapter 5, I'd like to read two verses as a text to give a basis for our study tonight. And let's consider this, if you don't mind. Let's consider this a sort of an informal study. And if there's something that I say that you don't understand, you'd like me to repeat it, or you'd like me to explain it again, why, just don't hesitate to interject yourself or raise your hand and feel free to make a contribution, because I'm going to call on you anyway to read and or answer some questions or come to some conclusions. Well, this is our text that we're going to read. I'm going to read verses 218 and 219. And this is Nephi speaking here. "And it came to pass that the Lord commanded me, wherefore I did make plates of ore that I might engraven upon them the record of my people. And upon the plates which I made, I did engrave the record of my father, and also our journeyings in the wilderness, and the prophecies of my father, and also many of mine own prophecies have I engraven upon them." Either that's a truthful statement, and this book that we cherish and hold dear is a history of a people that began a journey some 600 years before Christ. And they journeyed to this land, the Americas. Now, there are many people, most of the people in our country and many people in other parts of the world also today, have many different explanations for the origin of this book. And it would seem to me, you know, now for us, I think that it is vitally important that we are ready and able to accept this book on faith. That's the same way we have to accept all the promises of God. We accept the Bible on faith. We accept the miracles that we read of in the Bible on faith. There are people in our society today, and I'm sorry to say, they're ministers. They're ministers of the greatest, largest churches in our country today that no longer accept many of the miracles that it speaks of in the Holy Bible. They don't have faith in those things. They no longer have faith in the Immaculate Conception of Jesus Christ, in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, in the promise perhaps of eternal life. Although they're very reluctant to commit themselves on that, because why are they preaching if they have no confidence in this? It is important. You cannot prove all these things. We have to accept them on faith. And we have to accept the Book of Mormon on faith as well. And yet, we find ourselves constantly, if we like to witness about the Book of Mormon, if we like to talk to people about the Book of Mormon, we find ourselves constantly having to give, like Paul admonishes young ministry, we have to be ready to give a reason for the hope that we have within us. And so I think that that we need to have, and I want other people to have as well. And so if I want other people to have it, then I think I should have some reasonable basis for accepting this record as an authentic 6th century B.C. history, an account of a great migration of peoples from one land to another and all that went along with it. And so I would like to present to you some ideas tonight that I've found in study, and it takes a lot of study, and because of it I'm happy to share them with you, because we don't all have the inclination or the time or the opportunity to do it. I'd like to share with you some of these ideas that I have encountered that give me a reasonable hope in the veracity of these words that we have read, that Nephi began this record, and then it was carried on by others down through the centuries until the book came to a conclusion. But the record, this story that you're reading in your Wednesday evening class, was written not by Joseph Smith, not by Sidney Rigdon, not copied from some other manuscript that was never published back in the 18th century or the 19th century, rather, but it was written in the 6th century B.C. by Hebrew people. And there is ample reason for us to not to acknowledge that this is a true history of these people. Since the publication of the Book of Mormon, I'm going to say probably in the last 50 years, there have been many other documents that have been discovered and found, recovered, interpreted, translated by scholars of Semitic languages, Egyptian, Arabic, that are also epic adventures and took place about the same period of time, back in the remote distance where it's very difficult to prove them. And yet, scholars take these stories and these accounts as they find them, and they study them, and they make a decision as to their veracity or if they're just an imaginary tale, like the Arabian Nights or something like that. And so if they can do it, they have a basis for doing it. And I'd like to share that with you at this time. And these criteria are criteria that have been developed by a professor, William Albright, who is an archaeologist, an anthropologist, a study of Semitic languages of the Near East, of ancient Mediterranean peoples. He's an Egyptologist. He studies Arabic, and he's one of the men who has developed a set of criteria to use to determine if stories are true or if they are not true. And so this Professor Albright has used these criteria that I've kind of outlined right here to declare that the story of a certain Egyptian named Sinuhe is substantially a true account of an adventure that took place back in the era of time before the Christian era of time began. And this is the criteria that he used. Number one, he said, it's because the local color that is portrayed by the author is extremely plausible. The local color. This story took place in Egypt, and the author included within that story things that actually today archaeologists and anthropologists and Egyptologists know are true accounts of the way the Egyptian life was like. The local color was very plausible. The second condition that he used is that it describes a state of social organization which agrees exactly with our present archaeological and documentary evidence that we have. And so he believes then that this story was written in ancient times. And then a third one here is because the personal names within the story, the Amorite names, the Egyptian names contained in that story, are correct for that period and for the area where the story took place. And then the fourth criteria is that there was nothing unreasonable in the story itself. Unreasonable in terms of what we know historically about the things that took place at that time. I would like to add a fifth criterion. Since we're talking about the Book of Mormon, and the Book of Mormon is a story of a group of people that came to the New World, then I would say then that another criterion for identifying the validity of this record would be simply that the main elements in this story that is told here in the Book of Mormon would be found reflected in the traditions or the writings of the Indian people, who are the descendants of the people that we're reading about. And so using these four criteria, Professor Albright establishes that documents are either validly written in ancient times, or they're just tales, or maybe they're fakes. And using the same criteria, we can analyze the Book of Mormon, and we can come up with some very interesting bits of evidence. An interesting thing to me is it was written by a professor, Dr. Hugh Nibley, and Dr. Nibley is a Latter-day Saint. He's dead now. A professor at Brigham Young, an expert in the study of Arabic and Semitic languages, an expert in the Near East, an expert, an archaeologist, a man who was much published. And you know, many, many people who are adversaries of the Book of Mormon are going to say, well, hey, don't use Mormon guys for your authorities. Well, certainly we can. Dr. Nibley and other professors and doctors and archaeologists that are members of the LDS Church are every bit as valid authorities as are all the authorities, like Professor William Albright is an authority accepted and acknowledged and published in all kinds of professional magazines about biblical happenings. We cannot reject all of his findings just because he believes in the Bible, you know, and neither do we need to reject the findings nor the writings of valid professors and students of ancient languages in the Mediterranean area or American archaeologists just because they believe in the Book of Mormon. But Dr. Nibley made this statement, and I find it very interesting. He said that virtually everything we know, and you think about this, it's true, virtually everything we know about Palestine, about Israel, about Arabia, about Egypt, we have learned in the last, well, since 1850. And most of it we've learned in the last 50 years. Now, that's quite an important fact. If everything we know about Israel, almost everything we know about Israel and Palestine and the Semitic people and the Mediterranean people and their cultures and their lifestyles, their social organization, we've learned in the last 120 years, that means it wasn't known at all when Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon. Not only, you know, could Joseph Smith, we have often made the claim, you know, an unlettered, untutored, unscholarly individual like Joseph Smith could never have written this. The truth of the matter is, the brightest, most educated scholar in the world in 1829 could not have written this account, because what is contained in this account was unknown to anyone at that time. So that's an important thing. So what we're going to do today is consider some of the elements. And I got to quit talking and get at it here. Consider some of the elements in the story of 1 Nephi. That's all we're interested in tonight. Just one little tiny segment. It's in chapter 1 and maybe a few verses in chapter 2, and then they skip over to chapter 5 and you have the whole story of this epic adventure of the Nephite people as they left Jerusalem and came to the Americas, where they established a culture here and a great civilization here. We're going to just take some of the highlights out of that story. We're not going to have time to talk about any of the prophecies, all the beautiful visions there in chapter 3 and 4 and 6 and 7 of 1 Nephi. That would take another two or three nights to even consider those. We're just going to talk about the travels of these people, the story that Nephi told. And we're going to begin in the very first chapter and the very first verse. If you'd like to turn there to chapter 1, verse 1, we're going to begin picking up the story and finding elements of truth in this story that no one in 1829 would have known. I'm going to read verse 1. He says, "I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents, therefore I was taught somewhat in all the learning of my father, and having seen many afflictions in the course of my days, nevertheless having been highly favored of the Lord in all my days, yea, having had a great knowledge of the goodness and the mysteries of God, therefore I make a record of my proceedings in my days, yea, I make a record in the language of my father." Now this is an important element right here. He started right out with one of the most important elements in this entire record. "I make a record in the language of my father, which consists of the learning of the Jews and the language of the Egyptians." Had the author of this book not inserted That last little phrase there and the language of the Egyptians, scholars today could automatically declare it a fraud. Because all of Egypt and all of the civilized world at that time was greatly affected by the language of the Egyptian people. When Christ was there, they had been affected by the language of the Greek people. And Greek was one of the common languages. But in the days before Christ, 600 B.C., the Egyptian language was used widely and broadly because of the trade and the political power and influence of Egypt. It's interesting for me to note that here just a few years ago, even in the Holy Bible, the book of Exodus, another beautiful and marvelous, miraculous story of a migration of a people, the book of Exodus had cast doubts about it. And it was only as scholars studied it and found the traces of this Egyptian influence throughout their activities and their travels and their lifestyle that they concluded it really was a valid record that was written at that time. Now, he makes this statement that he's going to make this record in the learning of the Jews. I'm not going to have time. I'm going to leave out a lot of this. If I don't, we'll be here 2 or 3 hours, and I know you don't want to be. So I'm going to leave out a lot of this. I don't have time to talk about all of the vast amount of evidence there is that this Book of Mormon, if you took a blue highlighter and you went through your Book of Mormon, and every place you found an instance of a use of a Jewish or a Hebraic method of writing, you highlighted it, you'd have the bluest book you can imagine. It would just, as you turn the pages, it would just look like the Caribbean Sea, you know, because there are that many examples within it. I'm only going to refer to one tonight, and I'm going to refer to one example of a Hebraic method of writing that, well, it has a name, this Hebraic method of writing. It's called chiasmus. And as you notice here at the very beginning, I'm taking an example of this type of Hebraic writing from the 22nd chapter of Isaiah. The Bible is filled with this kind of writing. It's a writing style that was known to ancient Hebraic and Semitic people. And it was used widely by them. But when Rome came in after the resurrection of Christ, when the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem and crucified thousands and then shipped other tens of thousands into captivity and bondage in all the parts of the Roman Empire, this method of writing became lost to the known world. And it was only recently discovered. Now, these Hebraisms, this kind of writing is called a chiasmus. And these chiasms are found throughout the Bible, but they're not easily identified. And because of the translation of the Bible from the original language into English, some of them have been lost. And yet, today, we recognize that this kind of writing is found in the Bible. And a chiasm is simply a number of statements in which a word, or sometimes it may be a phrase, or sometimes it may be a complete idea, is used, and then there's one or two or three, and then they are written again in inverted order. So that the second half of it is kind of like a mirror image of the first half. He shall open, and none shall shut. And then we repeat those words, but now in an inverted order, and he shall shut, and none shall open. So that the bottom half is like a mirror image of the top half. This is just a little short one because that makes it easy to look at and to understand. A chiasm can have, instead of A and B, it can have A, B, C, D, E, and F. It can have a dozen parts or more. Some entire chapters of the Bible and some entire books of the Book of Mormon are written in this chiastic style. Not using repeating words, but repeating ideas or big events. Now, here's another example of a chiasm that is found in the Book of Mormon. And it is so important that we identify and recognize that this style of Hebraic writing is repeated in the Book of Mormon. I'll show you why in just a moment. And here, these sentences are longer, so I've only quoted the last portion of the sentence. But you can see here, under the prophet, by the voice of the Spirit, and then again, for by the voice of the Spirit, the Lord reveals himself unto the prophets. And we see the same two words repeated, but in inverted order, giving a mirror image. Now, this chiastic structure is really a beautiful discovery that's only been made. That's the interesting thing. Nobody knew a thing about it in the days of Joseph Smith. No one in the days of Joseph Smith recognized this chiastic structure in the Bible, nor in any other form of literature, and could have repeated it. No scholar who is a study of ancient Semitic or Hebraic languages would ever seriously say or consider that Joseph Smith or anybody could have written the Book of Mormon in 1829, because this chiastic structure is here used so thoroughly. I'd like to read a quotation now from a Bible. I'm reading a quotation from a Bible called the Companion Bible. I encountered one on a missionary trip in California. One of the sisters there had it and showed it to me. And as I opened it up, I was literally amazed. The entire Bible had been arranged in this chiastic structure so that it was evident. And the whole Bible has been, this Companion Bible, published in England in about 1972, and I haven't been able to find one in the bookstore. I'm still looking, though. But the entire Bible is arranged in this chiastic order. And this is what the editors say about it. I'm quoting them right now out of their introduction. Speaking of these structures, these chiastic structures like I'm demonstrating here, only theirs are far more complicated. This is what the editors say. They give not a mere analysis evolved from the text by human ingenuity, but a symmetrical exhibition of the word itself, and is seen to be one of the most important evidences of the divine inspiration of its words. For these structures constitute a remarkable phenomenon peculiar to divine revelation, and are not found outside it in any other form of known literature. Well, there the editors of this Companion Bible really gave a fine recommendation for the divinity of the Book of Mormon, because the Book of Mormon is literally filled, 1 Nephi and 2 Nephi, Mosiah, 3 Nephi, the authors there utilize this chiastic structure extensively. And here the editors of this Bible say that it makes a remarkable phenomenon peculiar to divine revelation. And so I like to keep that little recommendation there from the editors of the Companion Bible. Now, we want to remember that Nephi says he's going to be using the language of the Egyptians. And this is another interesting thing. And I would like to just point out to you here, briefly, I'm not going to spend much time at it, just point out briefly that the list of names written in green on top and then written in orange beneath, the green are names that come from the Book of Mormon. Ammon, for example, is the most common name found in the Book of Mormon. Ammon, spelled the same way or like this, and sometimes A-M-U-N, in Egypt, is the most common name in Egypt. And each of these names that we find here, not only are the names quite similar with the Egyptian names, but their significance of the names even have a great similarity, which is interesting to me. For example, Ahah here was the son of the Nephite commander-in-chief. And the same word in Egypt, in the old world, meant a warrior. And it was the name of one of the pharaohs. So we see a great correlation here of these names. About half the names that are found in the Book of Mormon, about half the names found in the Book of Mormon have an Egyptian basis, and about half have a Hebraic basis, which we would expect seeing from the very statement that Nephi has made. I would think that an interesting statement that is has been made by some scholars of the Book of Mormon. As they looked at they made lists of the names that are found in the Book of Mormon, because proper names are vitally important in identifying the language, the basic language, and the identity of a people. And they were amazed that they found no names there from Baal, no names that they call Baal names. Because in the Old Testament, in the Bible, the names even for God had many times attached to it the word Baal, that they picked up from the from their Baal worshipers in the land of Canaan when the people went there. and so these scholars were very interested. Why is it, they wondered, that there are no Baal names that are found in the Book of Mormon? And they thought, this is going to be a very great shortcoming in the Book of Mormon, that there are no Baal names, because the Old Testament is filled with Baal names. And then, in just the, I'm going to say in 1935, I believe, there were some letters discovered. And these letters were discovered from a group of refugees that lived in Elephantine, Egypt. Elephantine was settled by hundreds and thousands of Jewish refugees who were forced to flee when Nebuchadnezzar captured Jerusalem and Israel fell to Nebuchadnezzar. And those who survived the captivity and the death fled into Egypt, and many of them went to this city of Elephantine here in the northern, it's really in the northern part of Egypt along the Nile River. And now we have discovered letters written by these Jewish people. And in these Elephantine letters, there are absolutely no Baal names. And they're written at the same time that the Book of Mormon was being written. They're contemporaries of Lehi and Nephi. And they use no Baal names. And so then it was discovered in these letters that they use no Baal names because of a prophecy given by Hosea. And in the book of Hosea, the Jewish people were told, but they were told in not plain language at all. They were told, though in oblique language, that they were to use no longer the name of Baal. And so we find no Baal names in these Elephantine letters. We find no Baal names in the Book of Mormon. If it had been somebody who wanted to perform a hoax and take names out of the Old Testament in the Bible and put them in the Book of Mormon, we would have found a number of Baal names. And so what these scholars once thought was going to be something that would stand against the Book of Mormon, we see as a strong testimony in favor of the Book of Mormon at this time. Now, we're going to continue in our journey, and we're going to turn over to verse 28. 1 Nephi, we know what happened there in Jerusalem when Lehi had his experience. We know how he went about the city and how he preached about the impending destruction and the captivity of Jerusalem if the people did not turn to God. If they did not, you know, and other prophets were talking at the same time, if you don't quit relying upon Pharaoh, you're going to be destroyed. And yet the Jewish people relied upon Pharaoh for their protection against Nebuchadnezzar, and because of it they were destroyed. But before that, why, the Jews hardened their hearts against Lehi, and they threatened him, and they persecuted him and his family. Finally, they threatened him with death. And so we read here in verse 28, and it came to pass that he departed into the wilderness. He took his family and all of the possessions that they could carry, that they felt they deemed were important for them to take, and they departed into the wilderness. And this again, this goes right back to, let me get rid of this. This goes right back here to the cultural and social organization, the local color. This is exactly the thing that all people in the Near East did when there were times of danger. They simply took off out into the desert. When their lives were threatened, when there was a threat of invasion or of captivity or whatever, the people just took off out into the desert. And it was true of all of this area of the Near East. The desert was their refuge. Moses went off into the desert. Abraham went off into the desert. The prophets went out into the desert when they were fleeing their enemies. What makes this thing so interesting, you know, this little statement here that they went out in the desert, that's exactly what these people did when Nebuchadnezzar came. I'd like to have somebody find in their Bible Jeremiah 39. Somebody turn to that passage in your Bible. Jeremiah 39. Let's see what happened in Jerusalem when Nebuchadnezzar's armies came and lives were threatened. Brother Marvin, would you read that for us, please? Verse 4.
And it came to pass that when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, saw them and all the men of war, then they fled and went forth out of the city by night, by the way of the king's garden, by the gate betwixt the two walls, and he went out the way of the plain.
Why, yes, not only did Lehi and his family flee when their lives were threatened, Zedekiah and all of his armed men, all of his warriors, and those of his sons that were old enough to accompany him, fled out into the desert, into the wilderness, when their lives were threatened. Interesting thing here, and again, we turn to this Professor Albright. Professor Albright wrote a brief history of Judah from the days of Josiah to Alexander the Great that was published in the Biblical Archaeology magazine. And in there, he says here that when the Jews of the city of Jerusalem found out that the city was on the verge of destruction, I'm quoting him, they hid in the wilds during the siege. And when all else was lost, they fled to Egypt. And so they did the same thing that Lehi and Nephi and his family did. And that was the customary thing to do in that period of time. Flee into the wilderness when your life was threatened. And so now we're going to read over in verse 33 another event that took place in this journey. We read this. And it came to pass that when he traveled 3 days in the wilderness, he pitched his tent in a valley by the side of a river of water. There are several reasons that people object to this verse. Critics of the Book of Mormon point to this verse because they say, one thing they say, well, look, they fled out of Jerusalem. Here is Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, before it fell, they fled out into the wilderness. Now, this little place that you see right there, this is the Rift Valley that through which the Jordan River flows, and it ends up in the Dead Sea below sea level. But the Rift Valley continues clear on down to the Red Sea, and when it gets to the end of the Red Sea, it continues clear down here through the Horn of Africa. It's just sort of like the great big fault that's over in California, from the Lower California, the Gulf of Lower California, right up through the Central Valley of California. This was caused by gigantic movements in the earth, and it was a well-known road, and it went down to the seaport here of Ezon Geber, and they didn't take that. They fled into the wilderness. They probably crossed that King's Highway and got out here into the wilderness where they were unseen by people who might seek their life. The wilderness of Arabia and this area in those days was a dangerous place, filled with bands of armed men that were always ready to steal whatever they could from a caravan of any sort. And so they hid in the wilderness. But the thing is, the Book of Mormon, and so our critics say, you know, well, this is 150 miles from Jerusalem down here to the Red Sea, where they came to this valley that had a river of water in it that we read about. How in the world could they do that in 3 days? Not only do it carrying all of the things that they took with them, their possessions and all, but they didn't use the King's Highway. They went out in the wilderness, so it would take even longer. The thing that's important is the Book of Mormon doesn't say that they did it in 3 days. Let's go back and read this story here. Verse 28 again. Let's take a look at it. We're going to read verse 28, 29, and 30. And it came to pass, he departed into the wilderness, and he left his house and the land of his inheritance, and his gold, and his silver, and his precious things. And he took nothing with him, save it were his family, and the provisions, and tents, and he departed into the wilderness. And he came down by the borders near the shore of the Red Sea. So the first part of our story is that they left Jerusalem, they went out into the wilderness, and they came down near the borders of the Red Sea. It tells us nothing about how long that journey took. And now we read, And he traveled in the wilderness in the borders which were nearer the Red Sea. And he did travel in the wilderness with his family, which consisted of my mother Sarai and my elder brothers, who were Laman, Lemuel, and Sam. And it came to pass that when he had traveled 3 days in the wilderness, he pitched his tent in a valley by the side of a river of water. So he came down in an undocumented number of days. They came down to the borders near the Red Sea. And then, having arrived here, they took a 3-day journey farther until they came to a valley. And in this valley, we read, there was a river of water. And so there really is no reason for a critic of the Book of Mormon to point this out, because the story simply doesn't say the thing that they think it does. Now, it's interesting to note here that he says they camped in a valley by the side of a river of water. I would like to point out, and again, critics often scoff, you know, because we're talking about Arabia, and everybody knows what kind of a place Arabia is. So I think it's important for us to really know what kind of a place Arabia is. Along the edge of the Red Sea, up here in the northern part, there is because of this rift valley here, there is a range of mountains that raises up and extends inland just a few miles. It's just a coastal range of mountains. They rise up out of the sea, maybe 5,000 feet in elevation. As we move southward, the elevation increases and increases. Down in this area, they rise up to 10,000, 11,000 feet. And it is along this mountainous area that there is rainfall in many times of the year. I'm going to begin reading here from the Britannica Encyclopedia. The watershed of the peninsula is only 25 miles from the Red Sea in the north. In other words, in the north, the rainfall only extends inland for 25 miles in this mountainous area here. Some cyclones move southward along the Red Sea trough and provide some winter precipitation as far south as Mecca. I didn't put Mecca on the map, but it's right down in here. In March and April, some rain falls, and normally it is torrential. And so we find then that there is rainfall in this area. There is rainfall that amounts to about 7 to 9 inches a year. As we move southward, the rainfall amounts increase. Down in this area of Arabia, there was a vast civilization and culture there of Saba. And so it was the only known area at that time where there was extensive farming and agriculture. But there is rainfall along here, and there are river valleys that at some times of the year are running water. And I think we should remember that Nephi's identified the time of the year at the very beginning of his narrative. He identified the time of the year as being the first of the year of the reign of Zedekiah. And the first month of the year to Jews always refers to a spring month. And that's when the encyclopedia said they have cyclonic storms that move southward along the Red Sea in this mountainous area here. And that's when the spring runoff is the very highest. For all of that, you know, there I have a map that I hope to publish someday. And this map shows these areas along in here that I've identified with blue as containing water at times, from time to time, and it shows them as being tillable, arable areas because of springs, because of runoff that is there. The land is arable and tillable, and this is the area into which the family moved. But I think maybe most important there is Nephi's identification of this place where they made their camp is by the side of a river of water. You know, if that book had been written by anybody else, if that book had been written by by a young man from New York, it would have been alone sufficient to say he camped by a river. It wouldn't have been necessary to say a river of water. This narrative was written by a desert person, because most of the rivers in this part of the world are rivers of sand. They're dry gullies like we have out here on the western slope and down in Arizona. They're rivers of rocks and pebbles and sand. Throughout the Old Testament of the Bible, we read this expression, a river of water. In the very first chapter of Psalms, in Isaiah, in Jeremiah, in Lamentations, in Proverbs, we read where these desert dwellers spoke of rivers, and if it was a river that had a stream in it, they identified it as a river of water, something that a young man in New York City would never have, in New York State, would never have worried about doing. Also, I would like to take time here to just read a few verses of what happened when Lehi looked at that river flowing down into the Red Sea, and he was thoughtful, and he looked at his oldest son. He addressed his son and he said, "Oh, that thou mightest be like unto this river, continually running into the fountain of all righteousness." And then he turned and he looked at his other son, Lemuel. And he said, "Oh, that thou mightest be like unto this valley, firm and steadfast and immovable in keeping the commandments of the Lord." You know, there are a lot of people who look at the Bible and compare the Bible to the Book of Mormon, and they say, well, there's something missing in the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon doesn't have poetry in it like the Bible. But I'm here to affirm that these words of Lehi are words of ancient Semitic poetry. And they fit the pattern of the Semitic poet right down to a T. And I'm not going to take time to read all of the data and the information I have on it, but I am going to read a list of exact conditions that Semitic students have found, Arabic students and Semitic students have found, that were always fulfilled by the Arab poet. And I want you to listen carefully to this list of qualifications for this ancient Arabic poetry, and then we're going to consider again the words of Lehi. First of all, it says, they are songs inspired by the sight of water running down a valley. Secondly, they are addressed to one, but usually two traveling companions. Thirdly, they praise the beauty and the excellence of the scene, calling it to the attention of the hearer as an object lesson. Fourth, the hearer is then urged to be like the thing that he is beholding. Fifth, the poems are recited extemporaneously on the spot with great feeling. Sixth, they're very short, each couplet being a complete poem in itself. Seven, one verse must always be followed by its brother, making a perfectly matched pair. Now listen again to these words of Lehi as he looked out there and he saw something that was so beautiful to him. You know, a man who's just come for days through the wilderness and had to carry the little bit of water that they used perhaps. And now they're standing in this valley and there's a running river of water in it. And he spoke to his oldest son and he said, "Oh, that thou mightest be like unto this river, continually running into the fountain of all righteousness." And then he turned to his other son and he said, "Oh, that thou mightest be like unto this valley, firm and steadfast and immovable in keeping the commandments of the Lord." A perfect example of ancient Semitic poetry, something that nobody knew anything about back in the 19th century, but they know a great deal about in our present day. And you know, if there's anything in that little bit of verse that we've read there that really stands out as unique, something that only a desert writer of the old world would have thought of, it's comparing that valley with something that is immovable and steadfast. Here in the Western world, when we want to talk about something that is immovable and steadfast, what do we talk about? The mountains. We say, "Look at that mountain. Oh, that you were as strong and as steady and dependable and steadfast as that mountain." But in the desert, it is the valley that is the steadfast, immovable, firm thing to which people flee and upon which they depend for their life. And so another assurance that these words were written not by somebody from the Western world, but written by somebody who was from this very region that we're talking about. And then we come over to probably the shortest verse in the Book of Mormon, verse 46. And yet it says so much. Here, Nephi simply made a little statement. I'm not going to say much about it, but we could say volumes about it. And to an Arab, to a Bedouin, to a people of the desert, it meant everything when he said, "And my father dwelt in a tent." That said it all. That said why Laman and Lemuel were unhappy and rebellious and why they wanted to go home. That said what kind of a life these people were living now. That statement, if it were made to a person of the desert, would have revealed everything about this family as they had left the security of their home and their house near Jerusalem, and now they traveled into the desert. And they dwelt in a tent. They would become like the people of the desert there. And everything about their story is like the people of the desert, giving that plausible local color that means so much to the people of the desert here. The length of their stay in this valley. They stayed a long time in that valley. They stayed long enough for the brothers to go back to get the records. They stayed long enough to go back and get Ishmael and all of his family. They stayed long enough to be married there before they moved on. That, too, is typical of the Arabic people and of the desert people of that land. They went and they stayed in a place until, as the authorities say, until the land was no longer usable. The forage was... Now let's look at verse 67. Here's a thing that critics of the Book of Mormon speak about a great deal. Verse 67, and there are other passages that they speak of even more vehemently than this. It says, "And I, Nephi, and my brethren, took our journey in the wilderness with our tents to go up to the land of Jerusalem." He's going to go back up to Jerusalem to look for the records. But the thing is, the terminology here, to go up to the land of Jerusalem. Critics of the Book of Mormon are always talking about the passage in the prophecy in Alma where it says that Mary was going to give birth to her son in the land of Jerusalem. And they say this is a sure evidence, you know, that this book was written. It's a fraud because Jerusalem was a city. It wasn't a land at all. And so we need to identify that this is a valid way of speaking. We don't speak like that, but it was a valid way of speaking, and it points out to the authenticity of the book. I pointed out a little town right here, a few miles south of Jerusalem, called Lachish. Lachish was a city that fell to Nebuchadnezzar before Jerusalem did. They captured all the cities round about before they attacked and put the siege on Jerusalem. But the thing about Lachish that's important is, in 1935, some letters were discovered there written by a military officer. And these letters then were written at the same time, you know, that Nephi and his family were fleeing into the wilderness. So they give us an insight into the writing and the speech of these people, because here we have these letters that are authenticated as being from that same time period. And I'm going to read what one of these letters says. "We read of the land of Jerusalem as an area larger than the city itself, and even learn in one instance that a city," and this is a quotation from one of these letters, "a city of the land of Jerusalem, Bet Ninib, has been captured." It was the rule in Palestine, it was the rule in this part of the world to consider, you know, the large area around the city and all the inhabitants of that area as bearing the name of the city that they were near. This was a holdover from the time of, Alexander the Great. He lived in the city-states. They called them city-states. They were independent areas. And the city, the capital city, and all the land around about it took the name of that city. And it was because of this that Socrates can be considered an Athenian. When you pick up your encyclopedia and you read about Socrates, it says Socrates was an Athenian. But he really wasn't born in Athens. He was born in a little village outside of Athens, in the land of Athens, in the city-state of Athens. And so it made him an Athenian, even though he wasn't born there. I'd like somebody with a Bible to turn to Matthew chapter 10, verse 15 for us. You have a Bible there, David?
Yeah.
Would you find Matthew chapter 10, verse 15? And while he's looking for that, I'm going to read what Boyd's Bible Dictionary says about Sodom and Gomorrah. And I'm quoting it. It says, Sodom was the most prominent of the cities in the plain of Sidon. And we know that Gomorrah was another of the large cities that was nearby Sodom. All right? We know what Sodom and Gomorrah were, two cities that were destroyed. But I'd like to have you hear what Jesus Christ said about these cities. David, would you read that verse to us?
Verily I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city.
See, even Jesus himself didn't refer to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. He referred to the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. Not only were the city walls and the city inside destroyed, but the people and the inhabitants that lived around that great city made up the land of Sodom. And so all through the Book of Mormon, we find this allusion to the land of Jerusalem. It used to be that critics pointed that out as something that was... They were skeptical about that phraseology. Today we know, because of ancient letters and because of what the Bible itself says, that it's correct terminology. And it points out a verification of the writing of this. Now, we know that these brothers went on up into Jerusalem, and we know what they went for. They went up to get the records from a man who held the records of their forefathers. What was that man's name? Pardon? Laban. They went up to Laban's house. Laban was a mighty man. He was a keeper, perhaps, of the treasury. He had soldiers around to protect the city and to protect the treasury of the city and the records of the city. And the brothers had all kinds of trouble when they went up there. You remember who went first to see Laban? It was the oldest brother. They decided the oldest brother should go. And he went up and he tried to reason with Laban and obtain the records. And we know what happened to him. Laban threatened him and threw him out and then sent his guards out to kill him. And so they went back and they decided, what are we going to do? And they tried again to think of what they could do. And they said, let's go down to our house. And so I want you to remember here, you know, even though it says that Lehi had lived all his life in Jerusalem, they really didn't live inside the city walls. They had their home outside the city in the land of Jerusalem. And that's why they refer to it all the time. Let's go down to our father's house and get all of our gold and our silver and our treasures that we didn't take with us. Wouldn't be any valuable to us out there in the Arabian desert. And try to purchase these things. Well, we know what happened again. Again, they went and they took all these things. And Laban, as soon as he saw all this wealth, he desired to have it. And he stole it from them, and he sent his armed men out to kill them, and they had to hide in a cave. And now, finally, Nephi is going to go back by himself because he knows the Lord told him to go up there and get those records, and he's going to be faithful to that commandment. And he knows the Lord's going to provide a way. And so he went back, and here's what we read in verse 120. And oh my, do people get upset by verse 120 in 1 Nephi. I bet you have had the same experience I've had of asking people, giving people a Book of Mormon and asking them to read it, and they start in reading it, and they get to verse 120 and say, I can't read any farther. Oh, that's just too terrible. God would never do a thing like that. Well, verse 120 says, therefore I did obey the voice of the Spirit and took Laban by the hair of the head, and I smote off his head with his own sword. And people today, you know, they'll read in the Book of Mormon up to that point, and then they just get so turned off, they just feel like they can't read any farther. Can't read any more in the Book of Mormon. And these are same people, you know, that say, I believe every word in the Bible. I believe that God wrote it, you know, almost with his own finger. He wrote every word in the Bible. And they just completely overlook the fact that God had spoken to the forefathers, just a few generations before of this same young man and told him to go into a land and to kill every inhabitant that was in that land. Kill every man and every male child. And if it was a place where you're going to reside, kill everyone, right down to the children and the women and all the cattle, and leave not one thing alive. That's right there in the Bible. And yet, you know, people are very repelled by this graphic expression here that Nephi was instructed by the Spirit of God to kill Laban, that the Lord's people might have a record and a history of their books. And so I would like to read now a few verses. I'd like to quote a Mr. John Welch, who speaks about the law of the Jewish people of excusable homicide. He says, the law of excusable homicide is defined in Exodus 21, verses 12 to 14. In particular, the text requires, if a man smite a man so that he die, he shall surely be put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him unto his hand, then will I appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. Now this statute instructs people following this law to apply two tests in determining whether or not the killing was excusable. The first test is that the homicide be not premeditated. Now that's the first test. It wasn't a premeditated homicide in the sense that the killer should not lie in wait for his victim. This is thought to be killing with cunning or ambush. The second requirement is that the victim must be delivered into the hands of the slayer by the Lord. There's considerable evidence, as we read here in the Book of Mormon, that Nephi fully thought that this thing that he was instructed to do fell under the category of excusable homicide as it was outlined by Moses there in the 21st chapter of Exodus. First of all, when we go back, and we find them not knowing what to do, remember what it says in verse 106. Nephi said, I was led by the Spirit, not knowing beforehand the things which I should do. Nevertheless, I went forth. He had no plan of killing Laban when he went back the third time to the house. He had no plan to do that at all. He didn't know what he was going to do. And then the second requirement was that the individual is going to be delivered into his hand by the Spirit of the Lord. And so let's look at verse 112. And the Spirit said unto me again, behold, the Lord hath delivered him into thine hands. And then again, as we were reading here, he said, I did obey the voice of the Spirit, and then he did kill Laban. But he did it under the same law that the Jewish people had always used, that was a law for excusable homicide. There's another factor to consider. A writer named Steinsaltz says this, speaking of the laws and the thought of the Jewish people, he says this, to these penal laws we should add the special laws pertaining to the right of self-defense. It is a basic assumption in the Torah that if anyone comes to kill you, you should kill him first. What is more, every individual has the right to kill those about to commit a grave crime. And of course, you remember, we've already pointed out that Laban had stolen all of their goods. He had determined that his guards were going to kill these four young men as they sought the records that God had sent them back for. He was determined that he was going to commit a crime upon not only their possessions, but kill them and thwart their effort to have these records. And so I think people need to rethink, in light of Jewish law, they need to rethink this verse 120 here that so many people have bad feelings about. Now when they got back to the valley where the father was waiting for them, and their mother and others were waiting there, we read this in verse 159. And he beheld that they did contain the five books of Moses, which give an account of the creation of the world. So when they got these records, these plates of brass, we find that they had the first five books of the Bible contained in them. I find that significant. I find that significant in terms of this fifth criterion that I proposed would be important to establish this book as a true record. If these people brought with them to America the five books of Moses, there ought to be in the tradition and the literature of the Indian people some indication that they were familiar with the things that are contained in the book of Moses, in the book of Genesis, and other books of Moses. So I would like to now read from some of the traditions and the writings of Indian people. First of all, I'm going to quote an archaeologist named Donnelly who writes this. There is scarcely a prominent fact in the opening chapters of the book of Genesis than that cannot be duplicated from the legends of the American nations. Scarcely a custom known to the Jews that does not find its counterpart among the people of the New World. And a French explorer writes this of Cortez. When Cortez's men could talk to the Indians, and in a conversation with educated Indians, which has come down to us, one of them recounted a legend strikingly similar to the Old Testament story of the flood, even including the dove. I'm not going to read all of them. I have pages and pages of archaeologists who have discovered in the traditions and the written literature, and don't ever think the Indians did not have a written literature. They did. Have written literature that's come down to us to this day, and they're filled with parallels to the books of Moses found in the Old Testament. I'm going to close with one more here that appeared in our newspaper here just not long ago. After an aged Indian woman, Bessie Snake, lost her husband when he and his two mules were killed by lightning while plowing, his younger brother dutifully married his widow. That obligation is part of the religious traditions of the Delawares and some other tribes, matching a responsibility laid down in the biblical laws of ancient Judaism. The similarities of early Native American religions and ancient Hebrew religion are astonishing, says historian Duane Hale of the Creek Tribe, a researcher of the American Indian Institute at the University of Oklahoma. All American Indians were, and most are today, deeply religious and devoted to their belief in one supreme being. He emphasized that tribal beliefs focus on a monotheistic God called by various names. And how marvelous it is that we find this little account here, this little account that Nephi wrote, we find it verified in the traditions of the American Indian people. I'm going to now turn over and we're going to have to continue with this story in chapter 5 on page 48. And I'm going to have to quit here very quickly, so I'm going to do this as quickly as I can. On page 48 in chapter 5, we read now where their father has come arisen out of the tent. And he went to the door of the tent, and then we read, to his great astonishment, he beheld upon the ground a round ball of curious workmanship, and it was of fine brass. And within the ball were two spindles, and the one pointed the way whither we should go into the wilderness. The same is called the Liahona, sometimes called the director, sometimes it was called the ball, simply. But we know what its purpose was. What its major purpose was to direct these people on their journeys through a wilderness that they knew nothing of, no one knew anything of, and to a new world. And so this Liahona is a miraculous kind of thing. You know, it's not patterned after anything that man has ever made or seen. And yet, in Indian tradition, we find a tradition of the same thing. I'd like to read here from an archaeologist named Palmer about a beautiful textile tapestry that was found among the Tarascan Indians in Mexico. This is what he says. A most significant event depicted in the first quadrant in his presentation to the group leader of a ball suspended from a chain. According to Professor Nunez, the bird just above them represents a god. So its inclusion emphasizes the religious importance of the event. And the special ball had an important role in the migration of these people to the Tree of Life. The concept of a sacred ball was not unique to the Tarascan Indians. The Guatemalan Quiche and Cachiquel histories mention a sacred ball or rock in connection with their legends of migration from across the sea. How marvelous that we find, even in the traditions and existing to this day, tapestries that show something as unique in the traditions as the Liahona is in the story here of these people. And I'll not read the other cards about that. And then we read, as we read after that, we're going to read verse 16. And it came to pass that we traveled for the space of 4 days, nearly a southeast direction, and we did pitch our tents again. And in verse 18, we did go forth again in the wilderness, following the same direction. So after they left this river valley here, they traveled in a southeast direction, keeping, probably without doubt, keeping in the area of rainfall and some moisture and water here along this mountainous range. We know not where, you know, on the inside or in the river valleys or on the edge. But they went in this southeasterly direction until some other experiences happened. Now, in the bottom of page 49, another unique incident happened in this travel. I'm going to read verse 26, and I'm going to read it the way it is read in our new edition, our 1990 edition. If you might find that there's a word that appears a little differently in the 1908 edition that you are reading, if that's what you have. Now it came to pass that I, Nephi, having been afflicted with my brethren because of the loss of my bow, and their bows having lost their springs, it began to be exceeding difficult, yea, insomuch that we could obtain no food. And you might notice there in the third line down, in the middle of that line, it said the bows have lost their springs. Springs. This is a Semitic expression, a Jewish expression, of a noun of quality is emphasized by making it plural where it would just be singular in our language. And you think about a bow, what's the only qualitative thing about a bow? Is its spring. If it loses its spring, you've just got a stick, you know. And so the most qualitative thing about a bow is its spring. And the word, when it was translated originally, and then it was changed in our 1908 editions, and now in our 1990 edition, we've gone back to the original translation. It was translated springs in harmony with ancient Semitic kind of writing. Now we're going to read over on the next page here, verse 28. And it came to pass that I, Nephi, did make out of wood a bow, and out of a straight stick an arrow. Wherefore I did arm myself with a bow and arrow, with a sling and with stones, that he might gather food. What's unique about this? Nephi spending a lot of time talking about this little hunting trip and their bows and arrows. They're somewhere here in this area. And the unique thing about it is this, and I'm quoting here an Arabic authority. According to the ancient Arab writers, the only bow wood obtainable in all Arabia was the knob wood that grew only amid the inaccessible and overhanging crags of Mount Jassim and Mount Azd, which are situated in this very region where we would expect to find our pilgrims now on their journey. Those two mountains are right in this chain of mountains along where they are taking their journey, and that's the only place the ancient Arabic writers said that you could obtain any wood for a bow. Now he's got his bow, and he wants to use it to find food. He doesn't know where to go. And so they consult this Liahona. And the director says, go up into the tops of the mountains. And we read in verse 37, and it came to pass that I, Nephi, did go forth into the top of the mountain according to the directions which were given upon the ball. And it came to pass that I did slay wild beasts insomuch that I obtained food for our families. And Burkhart wrote a book called Travels in Arabia, and on page 403, this is what he says. and he's speaking here of the mountains between Medina here and the ocean, said, in these mountains between Medina and the sea, all the way northward, mountain goats are met, and leopards are not uncommon. And this is where the director told Nephi to go up into the mountains, and here's where the mountain goats were found. Well, we come to a place now where an event took place that was very, must have been horrible to these people, because the Liahona directed them at a certain spot to turn their course and go eastward. And it says that from this time on, we traveled eastward. And if they were to travel, if they had not traveled eastward, they would have gone right down here into a civilized portion of Arabia that they knew nothing about. This is where the Queen of Sheba came from, that had come up and visited Solomon several hundred years earlier. And they were now an antagonistic nation that were enemies of the Israelite people. And the Lord had them to turn eastward across the lower portion of the Rubal Kali Desert. The first known recorded journey across this desert here called the Empty Quarter was in 1928. And yet this is the very area that we find this expedition crossing. And as we read about it, says here in verse 55, came to pass, we did again take our journey in the wilderness. We did travel nearly eastward from that time forth, and we did travel and wade through much affliction in the wilderness. And certainly they did, because it's the most inhospitable area perhaps on the face of the earth that the Lord has directed them into, and for a marvelous reason. And the reason it would take them to the only place that they could call bountiful. We read a few verses on farther in his narrative, and he says, and we did come to the land which we call bountiful, because of its much fruit and wild honey. And all these things were prepared of the Lord that we might not perish. A land bountiful, where there was water and where there were trees to build a ship. And what an interesting thing it is, you know, that right here in all of Arabia, there is only one little area on the edge of the nation of Oman, in the territory of Dufar, are the Kara Mountains. And here in these mountains is the only place in Arabia that could ever have been described by anyone as land bountiful. And I'd like to read a little description of them. The climate of Dufar, the southwestern portion of Oman on the southern coast of the Arabian Peninsula, its coastal plain is regarded as one of the most beautiful spots in Arabia. The southwestern coastal plain contains splendid vegetation and bird life, but only 10 miles inland, the low rugged foothills of the Kara mountain chain begin to rise. Did you read that? Or did you hear that? The low rugged desert foothills of the Kara mountain chain begin to rise. We still don't know anything about Arabia. In the days of Joseph Smith, nothing was known about Arabia. In the days of Joseph Smith, the only guide to Arabia said that all of the coastland of Arabian Peninsula was uninhabited desert without a drop of water or a green leaf. And the only place that there was any vegetation was in the center. So had Joseph Smith or any writer of the Book of Mormon that day used any guide about Arabia, he would certainly have had them going into the center of Arabia to find the land bountiful, rather than down on the coast where they built a ship and made their voyage to a new world. So I find that really interesting. Speaking of the Kara Mountains here, an explorer named Thomas, who's one of the few Europeans who's ever seen them, writes this: what a glorious place. Mountains 3,000 feet high, basking above a tropical ocean, their seaward slopes velvety with waving jungle, their roof fragrant with rolling yellow meadows, beyond which the mountains slope northward to a red sandstone step. How interesting that the only place that could have possibly been a land bountiful follows the geographical description of the journey that Nephi portrays as we read just a few lines here. Well, I'm going to close here now by just pointing out a few things here. First of all, we read they built a ship and they put out to sea. They put out to sea and they crossed the sea. And again, I would say certainly there ought to be in the traditions of the Indian people, if their forefathers of many Indian people had come from across the sea, that ought to be reflected in the traditions of the Indian people. And so I'm going to read a few traditions here of Indian people. I'm going to just a few of them here. Goetz and Morley, who are authorities on the Mayan, are translating an ancient Mayan book called the Popol Vuh, and this is what the book of the Mayan says. Each of the tribes kept getting up to see the star, which was the herald of the sun, the morning star. This sign of the dawn they carried in their hearts when they came from the east. It's not quite clear, however, how they crossed the sea. They crossed to this side as if there were no sea at all. And again, I'd like to read from another ancient book called Recordacion Florida, again by some Mayan Indians. I, first Azib Quiche, write here on this paper of the coming of our fathers and grandfathers from the other side of the sea whence the sun rises. And perhaps here, maybe one of the most interesting ones, again from Racemos and Goetz, who are translating an ancient book. The principal chiefs were four. Together these tribes came from the other part of the sea, from the east, from Pa Tulan, Pa Sivan. These then were the three nations of the Quiches, and they came from where the sun rises, descendants of Israel, of the same language and the same customs. So certainly within the writings and the tradition of the Indian people, there we could get pages and pages of interesting verification of the fact that their traditions tell them their forefathers had come from across the sea, just as the Book of Mormon story tells us. Interesting, in the Book of Mormon story, you find many times the authors of the Book of Mormon are concerning themselves. They say, we are here upon an isle of the sea. You know how many times you read that. They considered that they had found themselves, the Lord had led them, to an island in the middle of the ocean. And that'd be quite natural after that long voyage they had. And again, I'd like to read a quotation, this time from an Indian chief, Red Jacket, who died in the year 1830, the year after this book was published. He's speaking to white men, and this is what he says to them. Brethren, listen to what we say. There was a time when our forefathers owned this great island, meaning the continent of North America, a common belief among the Indians. The Great Spirit had made it for the use of the Indians. So even this expression we find used in the Book of Mormon, an isle of the sea, is found in the traditions of the Indian people.